You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
So we talked last month about the JUICE spacecraft launched by the European Space Agency, which initially went off without a hitch until they found that there was a problem with their one of their antennas for doing radar measurements of the icy moons of Jupiter, which when it gets there in about 8 years' time, it's got a long journey to go. They found an antenna didn't deploy. Now, this is something that's quite hard to... you can't go up there and fix it. It's on its way. It's travelling away from the Earth at quite a rate of knots. And so they found this... The way they fixed it was to let it warm up in sunlight and cool down. There was basically a pin sticking hadn't been released to let this thing spring out. So they let it warm up and cool down in sunshine, in the sunlight. They fired the thrusters a little bit to try and shake it loose. And then they finally fired a sort of a mechanical actuator, which gave it a shock to then allow this pin to ping out. And to move millimetres, I believe. And then let this antenna spring out to go into place so it could then do its measurements. It's a bit like those things where you see people hit a car with a hammer to make it start working. It's a bit Heath Robinson, isn't it?
I don't think I've ever seen anyone hit a car with a hammer.
I think I've seen it in movies, but yeah.
I think of John Cleese hitting his car in Fawlty Towers with a branch. It didn't work. I mean, it seems quite a drastic thing to do, but you have to do it. You have to think of everything. And giving it a good shake and trying to warm it up. You know, you want it to expand, but it's also got a type of weld, probably, from being in such a cold environment. And you do see this, that things, two metal things, will weld together because they're cold. And it's not a very good weld, as was proven by the fact that they managed to non-explosively jolt it loose. But still, must have been extremely worrying. It was about 3 weeks that this thing was jammed.
Yeah.
The team must have been really not happy.
Yeah, it's and it sounds drastic to shake this thing and then fire bolts and that kind of thing. But actually, this spacecraft survived a rocket launch, which has, I think, shaking. They typically say about 20 G or something. These are rockets that are not rated for human spaceflight, so they shake quite a lot. If you can withstand that, it can withstand a little bit of shaking from its thrusters. I'm sure. So good that they got that released. And we'll let it do its measurements when it gets to Jupiter, say in about 8 years' time when it gets there. So the engineers and the technicians running it don't have to hold their breath anymore to see if this works, but we still have to hold our breath to wait until we get to the results from this thing. And speaking of results, we've got, it seems every month now, there's a result from the James Webb Space Telescope from JWST, which is coming out now. People are really doing lots of active science with this. There's quite a few that are coming out, but the result that's nice to pick on this time, I guess, is a star called Formalhaut, which is it's a relatively local star to our sun. It's been known since the 1980s to have a ring of dust around it, which is the leftover stuff from forming planets, a bit like our own kind of Kuiper belt and asteroid belt. A ring of rubble, but the improved resolution of the JWST compared with other previous instruments. We've seen several belts of stuff probably formed by planets. I mean, these looks like there were sometimes a lot of sort of grooves in records, in vinyl records, right, of going around. These are kind of formed. These are etched away by planets orbiting. So it's impressive to be able to see this kind of level of detail in this star, which of course is tens of light years away.
Yeah, and it's not a particularly faint star. You can see it with the naked eye. It's in the southern hemisphere of the constellation. I think it's the brightest star in the constellation Piscis Austrinus.
So, yeah.
So it's actually quite a nice link that this is a result about something that you could not necessarily see the dust of, but you could see the star itself with your naked eye. And that's quite a link that you don't often have with stuff that's observed by particularly infrared space telescopes like Herschel and James Webb. You mentioned that these are dusty or debris discs, and it's been known about for a while. It's the sort of thing which is left over, like you said, from planet formation. But it would be really nice to, if you know, like our solar system has an asteroid belt, if we could find out more about, you know, asteroids and things from other solar systems, because we've had interstellar visitors, we've had interstellar asteroids that have come from outside of our solar system, and it'd be very interesting to know if we could learn anything about this phenomenon. But I very much doubt that we'd be able to do any in-depth studies of the content of these dusty rings.
Fomalhaut is a relatively young star. It's less than a billion years old, about half a billion years old. So it's which compared to our sun's age of about 5 billion years is 10% of the sun's age. So it's still got a lot of this stuff going on. So we're seeing relatively early stages in solar system evolution. So as you say, it's interesting to compare that with what we see in our solar system, and maybe we'll get more when we get more in depth. Measurements from James JWST in the future. So we get these monthly results from JWST, but we're going to get even more results coming out from gravitational wave detectors. So we have the network of detectors, LIGO, Virgo and Kagera, are all in the process, as I record this, of turning on again. They've just been going through an engineering run, but what's called O4, Observing Run 4, starts in late May. Or started in late May, you listen to this, with the expectation of finding lots more events. They're more sensitive than they were before. They should see maybe two or three times as many events. So several a week of these merging black holes and neutron stars. So much so that I think to a lot of astronomers, in fact, the merging black holes are not interesting in their own right. They're interesting as a population. But we've seen lots of these things now. But the really interesting ones that get people excited are the merging neutron stars. And that's because they're not black holes. They're not just defects in space-time. Neutron stars have matter there. They have material. And that causes a flash of light. And that's where multi-messenger astronomy comes in. And get astronomers around the world all working together. It's going to be a fun... over a year this observing run's forecast for. But multi-messenger astronomy is a bit of a buzzword in astronomy at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, so multi-messenger meaning that the messages are sent via not only through one medium, so not traditionally astronomers would have just looked at light, but now we've got gravitational waves, but you could also get your messages through particles. I was reading a paper that was looking for a type of object called a blazar, which shines gamma rays in bursts. And they were using neutrinos to look for these. These are particles which very weakly interact with matter. The majority of them just pass straight through everything, stream through the Earth right now, and very occasionally you catch one. And there are various experiments all around the world which are looking at neutrinos. We're not quite at the stage where we've got neutrino observatories like we have with LIGO, because they're really you detect an event and it's you can count them, the number of events on your hand. The way that they detect them is they have like a large area that they basically fill with bleach, and the neutrino has a little flash as it goes through the bleach, and that's detected by cameras or light detectors inside this large space. And there's one in the South Pole called Ice Cube, and so there was a team that were looking at these blazars when they turned on and off, and seeing if there was a change in the neutrinos. And it was a really interesting way of doing this multi-messenger astronomy, but the results were inconclusive. So I'm not sure we're quite there yet.
I mean, Ice Cube's fascinating because it's about a cubic kilometre of ice with these little photo detectors suspended through. through that cubic kilometre, which is, as you say, picking up these flashes of light as neutrinos interact with the ice as they pass through this block of ice. Other detectors do it with water and all sorts of other materials, but this naturally present ice is the source there, and they can start to localize roughly where these are from on the sky, but it is tricky. I think it's fascinating to be able to kind of talk about doing this kind of astronomy, because we've talked a lot about electromagnetic lights and normal light and gamma rays and so on, and gravitational waves, but actually neutrinos are a bit of the dark horse of this. The neutrino astronomy has been going, in terms of taking observations, has been going for longer than gravitational wave astronomy, but in some senses it's got fewer events, I believe that have been picked up. So we'll see how it evolves and as these get more sensitive. But I guess the point of doing this is that you get more neutrinos out of these blazars in principle than you do gamma rays, and they're less likely to rely on being directed in the right, you know, relying on the orientation of these things. So if you can prove that you can detect these things with neutrinos, you in principle can then find them without having to rely on picking up gamma rays, so having a telescope looking at the right wavelengths and the orientation to be right. So if this can be shown to work, that's certainly a promising sign for picking these up in the future. So we have the start of the gravitational wave observing run 4, and we have the end of another run. So Peggy Whitson is a NASA astronaut who is retiring after a long career. She's has had the longest time in space of any American astronaut, I believe.
Any NASA astronaut, yeah. So she's spent nearly 2 years cumulatively in space, 665 days. She's 63 years old, and I think that's amazing that she spent such a long time in space. She's a scientist as well. She is a biochemistry researcher, and she's her nickname is the Space Ninja, so it sounds like she's quite formidable. She was the first female commander of the International Space Station, and she's clocked up more time in spacewalks than any other female astronaut or cosmonaut, for that matter. These type of stories are quite magnificent, really. People have spent such a long time. And we tend to think of astronauts being young people or people who train for a long time and then they have like a very short period where they're active. But actually, it's wonderful to see that, you know, it's something that people of all ages can do.
So we mentioned earlier that we had multi-messenger astronomy and these gravitational wave events. One of the challenges there is finding things, these flashes of light that go with potential events. And that's something that astronomers have been doing for a long time. People have been scanning the skies to find things that go bump in the night, or bang in the night, or flash in the night, I guess, for decades now, if not longer. We often think of the sky as being unchanging. All we see is the planets moving around, obviously the sun and moon and so on. But actually, if you stare at it in detail, there are often things that are brightening and dimming and things appearing and disappearing over time as well. So I spoke to two people who are heavily involved in this kind of search, Dr. Phil Wiseman from the University of Southampton and Dr. Cosimo Insera from here at Cardiff University. And the reason I was speaking to them is because there was recently an event that was not quite like any others. And I began by asking Phil how the sky does change.
To the casual observer, maybe in a town or a city, you'd probably be right. You'd look up and see the same few stars. Even in the countryside, you'd look up and see many, many stars. But you'd be very unlikely to see new stars appearing or old stars disappearing. That being said, most stars do change their brightness on a minute level. And if you have a powerful enough telescope, you will find that almost everything in the night sky does actually vary over time scales of maybe days, months, years, and millennia.
So we find these things changing, these stars themselves changing. You say it's hard to notice new stars, but now and again, new stars have appeared over over time. We have seen new things appear. So Cosmo, in the last few, I was going to say 1,000 years, but maybe even longer back than that, people have been seeing things appearing. How has that changed over the eons of people noticing stars appearing and disappearing?
I mean, one of the first appearance of new stars is actually relates back to Tycho Brahe. Tycho Brahe actually starts back in 1500s. He actually saw one of new stars in the night sky, and which is what now we know as the Tycho supernova remnants. And after that, people started to actually look more and more into up to the skies, up to, like, I would say the 30s, when actually for the first time Fritz Zwicky and Walter Bode, with a systematic search for looking for new objects in the night sky, so basically looking at the same part of the sky over and over, divided by a few days to weeks to months, they actually found new stars, which they were far brighter than all the other physical events that was known at that point. And that is where they coined the name supernova. And you all said about new stars. Nova in Latin, it means new. So it is in the name. It tells that is a new stars, and is a, in this case, they are very, very bright new stars, brighter than anything before. And these is said to be like more of a systematic searches. But I think what you actually make the real jump from classical astronomy to modern astronomy was the appearance of a supernova back in 1987, which all the people working in the sector, and even a lot of astronomers do remember as SN 1987A, because it was the first supernova observed in 1987. For all of those that do not do as a line of work, astronomers usually are very bad at naming things and creating scheme to name things. So what we decided to give the names to new transits, it was to give the years of the appearance and then letters. So we started with A, and then the second transit in that year, it was B, C, and et cetera, et cetera. Nowadays, we become professional, and basically we have 6 letters at least. So the first one observed in a year is, well, for this year was 2023, A. So rather than A, it was A. So, but by any means, 1987 was a supernova which exploded in the Large Magellanic Clouds, which is basically the backyard of our Milky Way. And as such, it was very, very bright and very visible for a long, long time, with the only difference that with respect of what happened back in 1000, when both the Chinese annals and the Babylonian recorded the appearance of supernovae, we had far better understanding of the physics and better tools and to play with. And so we started to observe it. We're still observing it now more than 30 years later. And that's actually what sprung a lot of people to devise new strategy to find these transits. And nowadays we have at least 3 to 5 what we call astronomical surveys. They look at the night sky multiple times per night, every single night, from different parts in the world. So we can actually every time see if there is something new in that part of the sky.
And so supernova 1987A is this poster child of transient astronomy, if you like, this very nearby object that we can study in great detail. But the name supernova, as you said, means a very bright new thing. Phil, when these were first seen a long time ago, they were given the name new because they were a new thing in the sky, generally a new object that had appeared. They're actually not a new star. If anything, they're quite the opposite. What are we seeing when we're seeing these things? What's the physics behind these new bright lights in the sky?
So the supernova itself is the kind of afterglow of the violent death of a star. And the way that star dies can happen in many ways, some that we think we know quite well, like its core collapsing in on itself and a rebound sending the material of the star out into space. Alternatively, you can have small kind of dead old stars that we call white dwarfs that reach a certain trigger point that leads them to undergo a chain reaction, a thermonuclear runaway, creating all sorts of new elements themselves are radioactive. And actually what we see is the radioactivity from the from all that new material being absorbed by the material that's been flung across space and then glowing as it kind of fades and embers away and gets bigger and broader.
And so these, you mentioned they're creating new elements. So these things are, of course, they're creating the elements that, or some of the elements that, that we're made of. So, you know, we talk about us, humanity, being made of stardust because the carbon and the oxygen, the nitrogen that we breathe is was formed in stars. But actually some of the heavy elements, so if anyone's got any jewellery on and so on, that was probably made in the core, these exploding explosions of these stars. But Cosmo, these supernova explosions, as well as giving us the chemical elements that we're made of, or some of the chemical elements we're made of, they can be useful for other things as well, beyond interesting in their own right of understanding the explosions of stars. How do we use supernovae for other aspects of astronomy and cosmology?
So first, I will say that on top of all the things we are made of, supernovae are the only way to create iron. So the iron that we have in our planets and we have in our body, it was created by a supernova. All the other elements can be created during the normal cycle evolution of stars, but the iron is only possible to the explosions. So the or everything actually is heavier than iron, it can only be created in that kind of extreme physical conditions. But apart from that, and telling us how the entire universe has evolved, supernova can help us to understand not only the chemical composition, but actually the proper evolution of the supernova. I think a lot of people at times, if they are if they like astronomy, they're the name or the words of standard candle. So supernovae, they can be used as signpost in the universe to understand how the universe has evolved in times and if it has accelerated expansion or has been slowed down. Because at the end of the day, these are very, very bright explosions. It basically means they can be observed very, very faint. It's something like you put a lighthouse and you stand in front of the lighthouse, you can see it, and then you go 15 miles back. You can still see it. It's a little bit fainter, but you know that that is the lighthouse, which has a certain value of luminosities. And then you go back and back and back. So you can measure the distance by the visibility of your lighthouse. The same goes with supernovae. For example, the one that come from the white dwarf that Phil mentioned before, which are called thermonuclear supernovae, they are very, very standard. They explode always very, very in a very consistent way, and they can be observed a very, very distance because they're also very bright. And since they're always the same, they can be used as a standard ruler to actually tell us how far is the cosmos and how actually the cosmos has been moved. The more we look at these supernova explosion further away, the more these are actually back in time. It's like having a personal time machine, because light is absolutely fast. It is as fast as it is almost inconceivable for us human beings. If we have to put the number, it's 300,000 kilometers per second. The fastest cars, they go around 500 kilometers per hour, 600 kilometers per hour. So this is absolutely amazing. But this is a very gigantic number, but it's still finite, it's limited. So the light is not immediate, but if the object is 900,000 kilometers far for us, it will arrive with a delay of 3 seconds. Think about that expanding for billions and billions of miles, and then we call parsecs and megaparsecs in astronomy. And that basically means that the lights we are receiving, it comes from our past, from the past of stars, from stars that we see dying right now, but actually have been dead for a long, long time, even before the Earth was even created. So in these measuring these distances and how much time these lights spend from the supernova exposure to arrive to us, we can understand what is called the evolution of the universe, and we can solve big questions in astronomy, which goes to understanding what is called the dark energy, which is the energy that moves the universe, and the dark matter, which are the two main unknown components of our universe.
And so this is one of the reasons why people have been going out to study these things and to find more of them, because it helps us do some of this cosmology of understanding the evolution of our universe. We observe these supernovae. They get brighter. They take over a course of a few weeks or months. They fade away again. And this is where we come to the topical story, which is there's this event that was found back in 2021. Phil, this goes with a catchy name of AT2021LWX. This event is not like the other event. How has this event been different from the supernovae that we would normally see with these surveys?
So first of all, I'm just going to call it LWX because the bit before we normally in transient astronomy, you start memorizing these phone numbers, and then you start giving them just shortened versions. So LWX lasts for years in our observer frame, looking at the way it gets brighter and fades away. It first started getting bright actually for us in 2020, but was only actually registered as a transient with the International Astronomical Union in 2021, hence it has the 2021 in its name. And that's because it was so slow to get brighter. Usually we're looking for things that were not there and suddenly are there. And this was a very slow, gradual brightening and an even slower fading away. So that's the first unusual part of it. And actually, that was the only thing that was noticed for a while, and it was kind of just left and untouched.
And was that because this was something that people went, this is this weird event, it's not behaving like any other event we've seen, we can't explain it, let's park it for now? Or was there a sort of a generic explanation of this is just something getting brighter and fainter, we'll never find out what?
Well, exactly. There was this some data taken. So the getting brighter and fading away, that is effectively you're counting the total amount of light that is appearing through your telescope, landing on your camera, and just adding it up, right? And then you put that on a graph and you see how it changes. To learn more about these things, you can then split that light up into different wavelengths, which we call a spectrum. And that can tell you a lot more information. It can tell you some of the chemical elements, as Cosimo mentioned. You can see if there's iron, you can see if there is silicon or carbon or hydrogen. You also can measure indirectly the distance to the object. And the first spectrum that was taken by our team, at least in 2021, was about when the object was at its brightest. And there was a remark, and the remark is still written down there next to that spectrum, that it just looked blue. There was no mention of a measurement of this expansion velocity, i.e. the distance. And there was no mention of any chemical features, no elements in there at all. The joyful part comes a year later in 2022, when a colleague of mine in Southampton, Chris Frohmeyer, was searching through the databases for a completely different type of transient event, and actually one that is usually fainter than normal supernova that happens a long way away from the middles of galaxies, out in the middle of nowhere. And as it just so happens, this thing doesn't appear to be associated with any galaxy. So it flashed up in his search, and we looked at the light curve again and then the spectrum, and that's when we found some very characteristic features absorbing, so dips in the spectrum that come where different elements absorb light at very specific wavelengths, that place the distance at around 8 billion light years. In technical terms, a redshift of 1, so more than half of the age of the universe ago. Once you know the distance or the redshift and the brightness that you see from Earth, you can calculate the brightness that the object must have at its location. And when you do that calculation, you realize that this really is extraordinary.
So this is one of the brightest things that we've ever seen. The brightest thing that we've ever seen, is it? How does this compare with other things?
So it's not the brightest thing we've ever seen. Far from it. It's not the brightest transient either. So there's a type of object called a supermassive black hole. That is a very, very dense region of space weighing typically from hundreds of thousands up to billions times the mass of the sun. And if you have a steady stream of gas falling onto such a dense object, it picks up extreme velocities, and a lot of the friction between all the different particles means that it glows incredibly hot. And you see that glow. It's one of the most efficient processes in the universe, if not the most efficient process in the universe, at releasing energy from matter. However, all of those have steady flickering, and they're always kind of on. You see them for decades. If you could look back into archives, you would find for hundreds of years. We think they last for millions of years in this state of accreting gas. What we haven't ever seen before is something this bright that has absolutely no sign of it ever having existed before in our data. We've never noticed anything about this part of the sky. There's no sign that it was accreting material at all. Then to suddenly reach the brightness of one of the brightest particular objects in the universe over the course of a year, and fade away again with no flickering like you get from a steady stream of gas falling onto a black hole, means that it's the most energetic single event, which we call an explosion.
All this light, what explosion? What exploded to create this flash of light?
I'll do it in reverse order of what we think. So there is a very small chance, it's not been ruled out, that this is some extreme type of supernova. There are theories around that suggest you could extract this amount of energy, but you would need an unbelievably kind of complex scenario. So it's possible, but highly unlikely. One type of transient event that does get extremely luminous is when a star falls onto a black hole. The star gets too close to a black hole, it gets shredded by the strong gravitational forces, and the material that is shredded forms this kind of ring, this disk, and there may also be some other complications of expanding or outflowing material. That's called a tidal disruption, a tidal disruption event. We have seen tens, maybe just coming up towards 100 of these things. To get the amount of energy that we see in LWX, you need a bigger black hole than you normally see for a tidal disruption event. That's simply because the bigger the black hole is, the more energy that you can extract. The bigger the disk of material, the brighter it glows. But the big caveat is that the bigger the black hole, the more likely it is that the star just falls straight in without being shredded apart. And to get the amount of energy that we've seen, we think you need a black hole around 100 million times the mass of the sun. And a star the size of the sun itself would just fall straight in. What you need is a star about 15 times the size of the sun. And so the chance of in its short 15 million year lifetime of it getting close to a supermassive black hole that are extremely, extremely rare and actually extremely small. They're tiny, tiny in comparison to the size of the galaxy or so. The chances of that happening are very, very, very small. But it is possible, and so we are trying to take more data to see if this is an option. We prefer the idea that there's a giant cloud of gas, probably hundreds, maybe thousands of times the mass of the sun. Maybe part of that has been disrupted by the black hole. We know that large clouds of gas and dust orbit supermassive black holes. And because it's just so big, that's one of the ways that you can extract a huge amount of luminosity, of brightness from the object. But again, it's still uncertain, and the work is now on to both collect more data to see if there's evidence for a cloud like this, and also to work on the theory of if it is possible, what would it look like? Does it look like what we saw?
So these events we said are rare, but actually, Cosimo, this is something, these very unusual events, these very rare events, are where the real power of doing these systematic searches comes in.
First of all, what the easiest things is, like, whenever you have an image of the sky, and then you would take a secondary image, you find the differences between the two. Like, all games find the difference between the two images. With thanks to new technology, we can actually subtract bits by bits every single part of the image. We can align the two of them, make sure that the same star in the same position, and then we just do mathematically one minus the other. If anything between the new one minus the old one, which we usually call as reference image, it does provide a new bright spot, some data, some pixel are lit up, that is a new star. And so we can try to understand if that is true or not. All the searches, they do apply machine learning techniques to identify spurious, bogus appearances of bright pixel that might be created by the instrument. You start with like 6,000 of these images per night. And then after all these processes between difference image, machine learning, and removal of non-moving object, you go down back to 80, 90 per night. And then there are people in those teams that are actually assigned every night to actually check and see if they could be consistent with transients. These are flagged and ingested into the systems. This is what we do nowadays, and we have roughly 22,000 of recognized transients per year. And that is basically given to the two powerhouses of these are the Zucchi Transient Factory in the US and the ATLAS Service, which is different telescope. The first one were in Hawaii, then they have the other in Chile, and now they added other two in South Africa and Canary Island. So you can see they look at the sky even different time of the night. So they go every night in the same position. By the end of 2024, we will have the Vera Rubin Observatory, which the UK is one of the main player against with the US. And that's basically, we're going to observe the night sky with a 6 meter diameter telescope. All the astronomical surveys which are discovering 22,000 transients have an average aperture of 1 meter. This is going to be a 6 meter. It's going to operate every single night per 10 years. Each night will have roughly 2 terabytes of data per night. And at that point, that is not going to be possible. So what astronomers have already done to discover and classify them without actually going and get these electromagnetic spectra are machine learning algorithms. And then it's going to be down again to us astronomer, make our judgment call on what we believe are interesting. The bonus is they give us better information to enhance our breadth of understanding of physics of not only exploding stars, but anything is happening in the sky at any kind of distance. So it is terra nova for any kind of research.
Phil, when the Vera C. Rubin Observatory comes online at the end of next year, you must be waiting with bated breath to see that all the kinds of weird and wonderful things that come out of this. So it's going to be a bit of a boon for those astronomers looking at for transient events, right?
It really is. Everyone is extremely excited and terrified because it's this unknown. You know, we have these machine learning classifiers. They can pick up all sorts. They're very good at telling between types of objects that we have already discovered and characterized. They're better at the ones that we have larger samples on. Now we're going to just multiply the amount of data by orders of magnitude. The lines between those are all going to get blurred. So who works on what is going to be a difficult decision. And then the completely new things, those unknown unknowns, are gonna come, and we're not necessarily sure what we're looking for, where we're looking for it in the data. That's, of course, both scary and extremely exciting. Will we find other extremely, extremely large explosions? Probably. Will they be as bright as this one? Maybe. Is this one on its own, or is it part of a larger class that we just never quite looked for before? We use this word too much in astronomy, but it really will revolutionize the way we study the night sky.
Well, we're certainly looking forward to the Vera C. Rubin Observatory coming online at the end of next year and all the things it will provide us to. But for this event with LWX to its friends, if we find out any more about it and any confirmations of theories, we'll make sure to check back with you, Phil, about what that might have been. So Dr. Phil Wiseman, Dr. Cosmo and Sarah, thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
So thanks to Phil and Cosimo there. Edward, this looking for transient events is something that LCO, your observatory, does an awful lot, powered by having lots of sites around the world. It's certainly a field that is growing in astronomy, isn't it?
Yeah, well, so we call it time domain astronomy. So things that are changing on timescales of seconds through to sometimes weeks, and you need observatories all around the world so that potentially you could observe something as one telescope goes into daytime. You want a different telescope to pick up those observations. You need them in the north and the south, because obviously you need to be able to see the different hemispheres. And Las Cumbres Observatory, that's something that we do. We also have the other thing that makes us fairly unique is that we have an autonomous scheduler. So we have an algorithm called CERL that automatically assigns observations to different telescopes, and that really allows us to do this dynamically and responsively, so we can respond to changes in weather, but also to alerts that happen from big survey telescopes that are normally finding these transient events. And then we do the follow-up.
So Cosimo was talking about using machine learning, so computer analysis techniques to analyze which events are real and interesting and so on, but actually you're using similar kind of techniques to schedule the observations in the first place. So at some point, computers can do everything, right?
Yeah, that's right. The computers will schedule the observations and then download those observations and tell you if you've got any data. And one day, ChatGPT will just write the paper for you. And
excellent.
You don't have to get involved.
And astronomers around the world will be out of a job. Let's hope that day doesn't come too soon. That's not going to happen, though, in the very immediate future. And that's all we have time for this month. Thank you to Phil and Cosimo, and of course, Edward. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. And you can also, of course, find us on Spotify. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.